From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to look at two of the most important things that government does. One of the things that government is supposed to do is to protect us. To protect us from bad guys of every sort. People who would do us harm, who would destroy property, cause injury, and wreak havoc. So that is basically a job for police services, is it not? Or is there another way to deal with it? The other important thing that government does is teach children. And yes, we do have a program in the United States, not forever, but since the 1830s and 40s, we have public schools where it's basically one of government's responsibilities to teach kids. So how is the current mania for learning at home, remote learning going, Zoom learning? Bethany Mandel writes in the New York Post that it is a complete disaster and may be doing more damage to our kids than actually helping them. We will speak to her coming up on the Medved Show. But first off, there is another question in education, which is, how do you teach our kids about basically the history of this great country? Kamala Harris has no problem at all, it appears, with the current lockdown of many of America's schools. They're going to be postponing the opening of public schools in New York, nation's largest school district, for a while. They've already canceled the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. Apparently, they're going to have like one block, but they don't want people walking up and down Fifth Avenue or Broadway because of the COVID-19 epidemic. But Kamala Harris was talking about kids returning to school. This is clip number 14. And in a recent question and answer session, listen to the way that the wannabe vice president responds.
And one of the biggest dilemmas for any of us as a parent is what to do about our kids in school. Yes. K through 12, college, all of that. And we all want them to go back to school. Right? But safely.
Okay. What was so funny? I don't understand. And of course, we have all become accustomed to Hillary Clinton's cackle. So what is it with these ladies? The last two women on a national ticket? Can we hear Kamala Harris again? Because if somebody wants to explain to me what she's laughing about. Remote learning, as Bethany Mandel is going to argue, is no laughing matter. But let's listen again.
Right?
Okay. She had said that given the fact that her father, who's a naturalized citizen, is from Jamaica, that she naturally enjoyed imbibing some cannabis-related products when she was in college. Is she still? I mean, I don't really fully grasp what is going on there. But I also don't grasp what is going on with some prominent Democrats and people on the left wanting to have an actual debate about whether or not it's appropriate to teach children to love America. President Trump, even though he seemed to be falling asleep, he did, spoke yesterday at the National Archives and I think gave one of the stronger speeches of his campaign because he was talking about an issue that really does matter. And he was concerned about kids in public schools being taught to hate, feel guilty, feel embarrassed, feel negative about their own country, about our own country. And there is no example, by the way, none in the history of the world of a nation that has been helped by teaching negativity about your own history. Now, you can say, well, what about Nazi Germany? Okay, in Germany after the war, they have been brutally honest in terms of what they've taught about the true evils of Nazism. But they've also talked about some of the glories of what Germany gave to the world before and what is giving to the world afterward. And certainly there is a nationalistic edge to any nation's instructions, except not if the left has their way. Here's President Trump deriding the 1619 Project of the New York Times. And it's a serious matter because there are public schools, all of whom get federal money, and they all do. And he's talking about public schools using the 1619 Project as part of the curriculum. Listen.
There is no better example than the New York Times. Totally discredited 1619 Project. This project rewrites American history to teach our children that we were founded on the principle of oppression, not freedom. Nothing could be further from the truth. America's founding set in motion the unstoppable chain of events that abolished slavery, secured civil rights, defeated communism and fascism, and built the most fair, equal, and prosperous nation in human history.
Okay, he's right. He's speaking of the National Archives, which is why it sounds so echoey. He went on and denounced in no uncertain terms that some of the riots and the demonstrations that are going on, and from people who may have learned the lesson of America hatred, perhaps even in school. Listen.
The narratives about America being pushed by the far left and being chanted in the streets bear a striking resemblance to the anti-American propaganda of our adversaries, because both groups want to see America weakened, derided, and totally diminished.
Okay. What's wrong with the 1619 Project? What's wrong with it is the claim that somehow slavery was initiated by the United States. We even had a comment by Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia that America invented slavery, which is completely, utterly wrong. America played a very minor role in the gigantic crime of the African slave trade, really a minor role. 4% of the slaves who were taken out of Africa actually went to the future United States. And the other aspect is believing that slavery was such an important part of the building of America. It was an important issue. It was our original sin, yes, but better defined as our original birth defect. We will be coming back because the originator of the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah-Jones on CNN, has lashed out against Trump, of course, defending her own work. So what does she say? And what does Breonna Keeler over at CNN say that is also deeply misleading? We will get to that and more with the disaster of remote learning coming up on The Medved Show.
Get 50% off any download at the Medved History Store by becoming an annual Medhead member. Join at michaelmedved.com.
On the Michael Medved Show, critical race theory is that doctrine that has crept out there and has come to dominate academia, actually. And critical race theory suggests that everything in the United States has to be seen through the lens of racism and white supremacy and white privilege. And that's basically the problem with the 1619 Project. The originator of that project, a young journalist named Nicole Hannah Jones, not a trained historian, by the way, and you can clearly see that in her work. She appeared on CNN with Breonna Keeler to rip President Trump and his insistence on teaching patriotism and pride in America in our schools. Here is Nicole Hannah Jones on CNN. Listen.
First off, this executive order, this sort of speaks to a misconception that I know you have tried to address that is being propagated about what the 1619 Project is, that it is not an attempt to rewrite history about when this nation was founded. If the president had actually read the essays in this, what do you think would be an honest takeaway of what they're about?
Well, yeah, the 1619 Project is really about giving us the history and the understanding to see how slavery was foundational to America and the way that the legacy of slavery still permeates modern society. But of course, we know that 1776 was the founding of this country. The project does not argue that 1776 was not the founding of the country. But what it does argue for is that we have largely treated slavery as an asterisk to the American story, as marginal to the American story. And this project is trying to place slavery at the center where we believe it belongs.
Why do you think the president, and look, millions of people agree with him, are so resistant to this examination of what slavery has meant to this nation, even when you look at present day, and it's right before you, you can see the fallout from slavery very much today.
Okay, this idea that you can see the fallout from slavery very much today, It's so difficult when that is your mindset. And one of the points that black scholars like Wilfred Riley or Shelby Steele or Thomas Sowell will make is that if slavery is so much with us today, then how is it that black people made so much tremendous progress, particularly in the 1940s and 50s, and with the civil rights movement. And yet you want to claim that after all that progress, with racial discrimination becoming illegal in the 1960s, and in every form of American life, in terms of housing, in terms of education, in terms of hiring of people, jobs, racism is illegal in America. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Still exists, of course. But to claim that the burden of slavery is still dominant in America, the other thing she said is she said slavery is foundational to America. If you look at the early documents of the first colonies, and including the Mayflower Compact that the Pilgrims used in 1620 to declare their intentions, nowhere do they say that slavery is foundational, that we want to build a slave-based economy or country or system of government. No one said that, except the Confederacy. And again, they're right that that aspect of the Confederacy should get full attention. And by the way, it does. If you look at your children's textbooks or anyone's textbooks from even 20, 30, 40 years ago, you will not find any attempt to whitewash the criminal, cruel, outrageous nature of slavery. And yes, Alexander H. Stephens, it's Alexander Hamilton Stephens, the former congressman from Georgia, the vice president of the Confederacy, in his cornerstone speech at the beginning of the Confederate desire to break apart and destroy the United States, actually spoke about the entire purpose of our new nation is to defend slavery, which he believed was a positive good. You will not find any of the founders of the country who said that. It doesn't exist. Even those who were slave owners were apologetic about it. And of course, George Washington freed the slaves at the end, his slaves at the end of his life. It is completely, completely outrageous. And it's wrong. And part of this actually carries over into the entertainment world. There is a new movie, and it's the first movie I've ever seen that actually makes reference on screen to, and it's not a documentary, to critical race theory. It is criminal race theory, but to critical race theory. And the movie is called Antebellum. And Jeremy, if we can go to clip number 21, this is a movie with Janelle Monáe, who's a wonderfully talented star. It has a gifted co-director who's also African-American, Gerard Bush. And the movie actually focuses, for its first third, it focuses on the experience of a very horribly oppressed slave girl whose name is Eden, who's played by Janelle Monáe, who was brutalized, attacked, raped, allowed to speak to her fellow slaves, beaten. It highlights all the cruelty of slavery. But then there's another part of the movie. Well, listen to the clips.
We are descendants of the gods. This land was always ours, but we must never relent.
You're from Virginia, right? I can tell you're special.
We are the future.
You're not like the others.
That's over.
What is the plan?
We go tonight.
Okay, they're plotting escape. Here is the point. Janelle Monáe plays a dual role. And part of her role, she plays a professor and media star and best-selling author in today. And you don't really understand because the movie moves from one to the other. And if I told you why she plays a dual role, it would give away the movie's one surprise. And that surprise is kind of okay. But let me mention to you that the prominent professor who is an advocate of critical race theory, happily married, beautiful home, beautiful husband, beautiful life, she is also brutalized and brutalized by people who honor the Confederate traditions. So this idea, by the way, Antebellum, two stars, it's well shot. The performances are incredibly thin. And the entire movie is propaganda, not any form of entertainment. It is clearly rated R for loads of brutality. We'll be back with remote learning, another disaster, coming up on The MedVed Show. On The Michael MedVed Show, there's a powerful piece in the New York Post by Bethany Mandel. And it's the kind of piece that I suspect every parent with a school-aged child will want to confront. It's it raises a very, very significant point that I had not considered before, which is, and one of the things that I've written about Bethany for years and years and years is the problem of too much screen time for kids. Our three kids were raised in a TV-free household, in fact. And yet part of the problem with remote learning is, doesn't it totally promote more and more and more and more screen time just when pediatricians and other experts tell us not to do that? Bethany Mandel is a conservative American author and a political and cultural commentator who writes for The Federalist, The Jewish Daily Forward, and Acculturated. Her new piece on remote learning as a disaster is over at the New York Post. Bethany why do you think it is that people didn't want to associate the dangers of remote learning with the general dangers of screen addiction?
So I think that there's a little bit of a difference with watching a movie on an iPad versus doing remote learning. But I've noticed anecdotally, but over the course of dozens of conversations with friends, that the result is basically the same. The kids end the day completely fried out on technology. They're spending up to 6 hours a day, even in elementary school, and they are afforded few breaks, and they just are expected to sit there and be engaged. I have a friend who's teaching a college course, and she had to spend 4 hours on Zoom a couple days ago. And she said, I at the end of the day, feel like I'm about to rip my hair out. I don't understand how this is an expectation of children. And so that her experience actually led me to write this piece, because I felt like it was an obvious point that no one was making, that screens are bad for kids. We've heard this for years and years, and yet the people who are supposed to be the caretakers of our children's education are the people that are now putting them on screens.
So what do we do about it? I mean, I understand that in the New York City schools, they are postponing reopening most of the schools. Isn't that right?
Yeah. They have no sort of end date in sight. They were thinking that they were going to be somewhat on Zoom and somewhat not. And the principals are hearing at the same time as the general public what the Department of Education is doing in New York City. But they have no idea. And the funny thing is, Bill de Blasio thinks that he should be congratulated because he's holding the schools to the highest gold standard. And that's why they can't open, because they can't reach that gold standard. But they've really just left a lot of parents in New York City in the lurch. And the people who can afford to leave will. And the people who can't are the people who have already lost their jobs because they're dishwashers and they're waiters and everything. And this is really going to exacerbate a lot of economic tension in New York City that was already present 6 months ago.
What's the alternative for parents who look, as you have, at the experience of remote learning and understanding it's not working well? By the way, there's another piece in Esquire that has, from the left, almost some of the same objections you do to remote learning. What do parents of the left and the right and the center, all parents, do as an alternative to the remote learning?
So, I mean, it's not an ideal situation, but I think they need to pull their kids out and homeschool them. And I've said this to a lot of parents, and people are saying, well, I don't have time. I'm working full time. And I said, yes. And how many hours a day are you spending on coordinating remote learning for your child? You're already spending hours a day, and you're already home with your child helping, because you have to be physically present in the home for legal reasons. So look into the hour or two that you might spend a day homeschooling kindergarten versus the 5 or 6 hours that your child is spending on Zoom when they're not really learning. And they're not only not learning, but they're also developing a deep hatred of learning and associations with school that are going to have lasting implications for a lifetime. There's a lot of homeschool curriculums out there. Even in high school, you can expect to spend 3 or 4 hours homeschooling, and a lot of that is self-directed. And the younger years, the time commitment is a lot smaller. But it's going to require a little bit more work on the front end, but so many rewards on the back end. And I'm not saying this as like someone who homeschools and trying to proselytize, which I do, but just from a logistical standpoint, it's a lot easier than what people are doing, and the returns are much greater.
In your piece, you cite our friend, who's been a frequent guest on this show, Naomi Schaefer Riley, about the importance of reading aloud. Explain.
Yeah, so that was actually Megan Cox Gordon, who wrote a book called The Enchanted Hour. And she wrote an entire book about the beauty and the power of reading out loud in this sort of distracted age. And she writes a lot about the dangers of screen time, which is why I actually went to her for a quote, because she talks a lot about the synapses in children's brains that are not being formed because they're spending all of their time on screens instead of reading out loud. But the power of reading out loud is so vast. There's so much more vocabulary that they're being exposed to. It's so much more enriching, and they're forming deeper connections with the material than they would be just sitting at Zoom. I've heard from probably hundreds of people that up to 80% of the time that people are on Zoom, they're troubleshooting. Can you hear me? Unmute yourself. No, press this button. No, Tommy, are you there? Tommy. And it's not like you're in a classroom where you can sort of stand in front of a child and get their attention. And the difference with reading out loud is you have your kid on your lap, and it's a really beautiful way of bonding and exposing them to new ideas and new vocabulary.
And in the Esquire piece that I mentioned, The Crushing Reality of Zoom School by Dan Sinker, it's actually very amusing. He talks about people who forget to mute their Zoom connections. And some of the things that spill over into this, quote, virtual classroom of parents arguing with each other or arguing with a bill collector. And there's all kinds of extraneous stuff. I mean, that never would be allowed in a real classroom, and that level of distraction, not just for you at home, but for other kids who are listening online, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was a horror story of a kid actually, their parent shot their other parent while they were on a Zoom call, and every kid in the classroom saw it on the Zoom call. And that's something that that Naomi actually, Speak of the Devil, wrote a fantastic piece for the Washington Examiner magazine, which, all full disclosure, it's my husband's magazine. He's the executive editor. But she wrote a fantastic piece for his magazine about the abused and neglected children of this pandemic, and they're now spending all of their time in abusive households without mandated reporters sort of watching over them. And the results are catastrophic and really quite tragic.
Let us hope that we get some relief of every sort, not just the vaccine coming up. We're now told the president did another press conference today. We should have vaccines for everybody by about April of next year. But let us hope that we can get kids back to school before then. Wouldn't you assume that we can?
I mean, I think we should have before this. It doesn't make any sense to me that we couldn't figure out how to get low-risk teachers and low-risk students into classrooms and then pair up high-risk students and high-risk teachers on Zoom and have more one-on-one tutoring. And I don't understand. And I think at the end of the day, it's all the teachers' unions. And it's funny, I live in Montgomery County where I don't think we're ever going to open back up. I think this is just our new reality now in Maryland. And in our county executive announced yesterday that he's opening up outdoor concert performances. And to which I respond, why don't you have outdoor performances of this thing called kindergarten?
Wouldn't that be something? Bethany Mandel, thank you for your piece. You can read it at michaelmedved.com. It's posted up there. When we come back, the cuties controversy, The Devil All the Time, and more from Hollyweird coming up. And on the Michael Medved Show, looking forward to a very special weekend where I hope the smoke clears in the Great Northwest and any smoke in your life clears away as well. Tonight is not only the Sabbath in the Jewish world, it is also the beginning of the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and again followed 10 days later by Yom Kippur. It's very rare what it occurs on the Sabbath, and very special, and meaning a time, serious time, for taking stock. And let us take stock of some of the offerings from Hollyweird. Okay, I'm going to dispense with the best new movie very quickly because of time considerations. There's a film called The Social Dilemma, which is a documentary. It's on Netflix, and it is eminently worth seeing. It is basically a series of very top people from Google and Facebook and from Twitter and more, top executives who are now concerned about what the industry is doing and its impact on our children and our families. It is an important film. It is three stars. it is has a dramatization in it of a family and some of the impact of social media on that family. So it's much worthwhile. Now, another film from Netflix is already inspired gigantic controversy of a political kind and not just of a movie kind. Why? Because Cuties has been promoted with some extremely salacious trailers and ads that make you think that the movie is something that it's not. It's not a good movie. It's a bad movie. It's an incredibly depressing movie. But it is also not pornography. What has upset people so much about it is it's supposed to be about 11-year-old girls. They used actual actresses who were 12 to 14 in the film. And the actresses are playing, it's a story that is a film festival winner about a young Senegalese immigrant to France who joins up with another group of dancing girls for a competition where they're going to dance to hip-hop music. And yes, they are twerking and bumping and grinding. And the dancing is disgustingly sexualized for girls who are supposed to be 11. But the real focus of the movie is not on that, and there is no sexual contact or actual sexual behavior of any kind in the film, just the dancing. And the film is about this girl's struggle with her very traditional Muslim family. And does it deserve all the condemnation it's received? It deserves condemnation because of the way they've promoted it. But actually, people who are looking for some truly outrageous content, they're not going to find it in Cuties. 1.5 stars. The film is rated for R for language. And by the way, it is dubbed into English in the version that is generally available now. It's a French film originally. I think part of the acclaim for the film is that it was made by clearly a talented writer-director named Maimouna Doukour, who herself is a Senegalese immigrant to France. Okay, next film is the end of a trilogy of Netflix films that we're doing. We've talked about the good and the bad, and this is one that is definitely ugly. It is called The Devil All the Time. And the film is almost unbelievable in its levels of violence and outrageous attacks on people of Christian faith. They associate Christianity as some kind of evil, mind-warping cult that leads people to murder and rape and animal crucifixion, and every kind of horror. What gives the film its attention is, first of all, it's 2.5 hours long. It's based on an acclaimed novel about a real town called Knock'em Stiff, Ohio, in southern Ohio, and it takes place in southern Ohio and West Virginia between the end of World War II and the mid-60s. And the film stars people like Robert Pattinson and Tom Holland, who was the Spider-Man, and a bunch of European actors doing some pretty bad semi-Southern accents. Listen.
Some people would say it's just dumb luck. Others would tell you it was God's plan.
Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness.
When people look back on it, they had no other choice.
Got time for a sinner.
Okay, everyone is a sinner in this film except the people who are detached from religion. It's outrageous, and it is truly gruesome to watch. The film goes from the merely disturbing to the outright disgusting, with suicide, murder, mutilation, and Robert Pattinson, the heartthrob from Twilight series, plays a pastor who, he seduces young girls, telling them, oh, I want to see you as God created you. The film, I have not read the novel, The Devil All the Time. It is narrated, the film, by the author of that novel, Douglas Ray Pollock. And 1.5 stars for The Devil All the Time. It is rated R, an emphatic R for rancid and nightmarish. And frankly, difficult to watch. Blackbird also takes up a controversial issue. And this features Oscar winner Susan Sarandon. It features Oscar winner Kate Winslet and Sam Neill and Mia Wasikowska, who, by the way, is also in The Devil All the Time. And this is a film where Sarandon plays a grandmother who calls her family together to participate in helping her end her life because she has ALS, she has a wasting disease. It's based on a Danish film. And despite some good acting, the film doesn't convince you for a moment. Listen.
Can we all behave as normally as possible?
Yeah. Okay.
Got it.
Okay.
You got it? All right.
Okay. Great.
Jonathan has a hard time talking about it.
Telling grandma?
No, I don't.
It's illegal, right?
How are you going to do it? When's it happening?
Soon, kiddo.
I'm going to call 911 and report a suicide attempt.
Are you sure? Because she says she's ready. She's ready, but I'm not.
Okay. The film is a melodrama. The performances are, as you would expect from a distinguished cast, universally solid. It is directed by Roger Michell, a gifted British director. But this is really, it's one of those films where everybody in this family seems to be well-to-do. They come to a beautiful beach house, which was actually filmed at the beach in Britain. It's supposed to be Connecticut. And the film never raises the deeper moral issues of suicide because there is never any passionate argument by anyone in this family. And they argue back and forth, and there's one little melodramatic surprise at the end. It is rated R for lots of difficult language and lots of confrontations. It feels theatrical and staged, but you can't take away from the compelling performances. 2.5 stars for Blackbird. It's precisely the kind of film that is likely to be grossly overrated by many critics and perhaps even by some Oscar voters. Okay, having done those films, all of our film reviews, including some films we haven't gone to yet, are up on our newsletter, and you can sign up for our newsletter. It's totally free. Go to michaelmedved.com and sign up for the Medved newsletter. You can also become a Medhead member for 11 cents a day. Use the promo code SUMMER. I think we're still counting SUMMER. SUMMER 40 because of the one-third off that you get. And by the way, coming up on Monday, we're going to be joined by Bill O'Reilly. He's the author of 15, yeah, count them, 15 different number one bestsellers. Many of them are part of his Killing series. He's now killing Crazy Horse in a shockingly politically incorrect and historically accurate book about America's, as he puts it, merciless Indian wars. We'll also talk about Van Morrison, legendary rocker. He's now 75. He has a new cause and new songs. The cause? He hates coronavirus restrictions. We will talk about that and much more in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Join Washington